Welcome to the Cyber Ranch Podcast, recorded under the big blue skies of Texas, where one CISO explores the cybersecurity landscape with the help of friends and experts. Here's your host, Alan Alford, President and CISO at Alan Alford Consulting.
Howdy, y'all. Alan Alford here. And what you are about to hear is a live recording. I recorded three shows in a row live at Zero Trust World 2024 in Orlando, Florida. Now, Zero Trust World is sponsored by ThreatLocker. And ThreatLocker, before you hear the show, has this little bit to offer you. ThreatLocker recognizes that cybersecurity starts at the endpoint and has built a Zero Trust endpoint protection platform that strengthens your cyber defenses from the ground up. ThreatLocker application allow listing, ring fencing, and network control offer seamless cybersecurity for organizations in any industry. With ThreatLocker in your cybersecurity arsenal, you can sleep better at night knowing that known and unknown software, application exploits, and even network traffic can all be blocked by default. If you're looking for a proactive solution that will keep your business better protected in the face of cyber threats, check out ThreatLocker by visiting ThreatLocker.com and tell them that you heard about them down here at the ranch. Howdy, y'all, and welcome to the Cyber Ranch Podcast being recorded live at Zero Trust World in Orlando, Florida, a show that is put on by ThreatLocker. With me today is James Keeler. James, who are you with?
I'm with LMT Technology Solutions. We're an MSP in upstate New York.
Upstate New York MSP. All right. So you were on a panel talking about incident response.
Yes, I was.
And you've got a background with incident response and kind of regarded as an expert in that area. So I guess my first question for you is, what is your philosophy of incident response?
My philosophy is avoid it at all costs. I don't mean that as a practitioner or as a cybersecurity professional, but avoid having the incidents and having to go through the pain of incident response.
I love it. I love it. An ounce of prevention is more than a pound of cure, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. How about the tenets of incident response?
Prepare. That's you cannot prepare enough for an incident happening. And the more you prepare, the easier it's going to be when things actually go wrong.
Okay. So steps of an incident. Let's walk through, you get the phone call. Of course, it's Sunday night at 2 a.m, right?
Actually, no, it's usually Friday night before I'm going on vacation. I usually have a long trip planned. It'll be about 4:55. So I'm still at my desk, just packing up, ready to go. And then the call comes in.
The call comes in. And let's say, let's pick a classic. It's a ransomware incident. Some user tells you, I can't access my files. And there's some weird note about Bitcoin on my computer.
Right.
All right. Where do we go from there?
Yeah. First step's containment. Before I'm even picking up the phone to go to other people, absolutely getting the containment piece taken care of first. So, lock things down as much as you can to stop the spread and damage.
Right.
If you're lucky, you can even head it off before it gets further into the environment. Probably not, because by the time they display the splash screen, they've usually already done a lot of their dirty work.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But yeah, try to tie that off. Usually I bring in some network people and say, hey, cut the network logically, because it'll take us probably half an hour to drive where we have to go, if we can even get there. Yeah. So first thing is just logically trim the network and try to contain that area and isolate it as much as possible.
Okay. And as an MSP, you guys have the unique situation of multiple customers who maybe connect to some of you. You've got customers connected into you, and you in turn are connected to other customers. Are there any direct connections where you have to fear about ransomware hopping to you?
that's one of the very first things we architect in our design. Absolute segmentation between customers and ourselves. In fact, we don't even connect directly anymore. We used to maybe 10 years ago.
So it's all SaaS now.
Yeah. Well, and at least we use some clever jump boxes or things like that if we have to really get too deep.
Okay. So SaaS and jump hosts. That sounds smart. So you don't have to worry about spreading infection laterally or vertically either.
Right.
So one client gets hit, it's at one client.
Absolutely. Yeah. The one thing that terrifies me is if the MSP itself, if we get hit, a clever adversary could probably leverage our tools and push that out to customers. Right. So that makes me lose sleep at night.
Right. It's paramount that you guys do that ounce of prevention, right?
We need about 30 pounds of prevention, because MSPs, I don't know if you've watched the news or anything, but they're one of the top three targets. Cloud service providers are probably number one. Software development providers are up there pretty close, and MSPs are right in there too.
Yeah. That makes good sense.
Why attack, Joe and Tom's machine shop on the corner and hit one victim when you can hit an MSP and hit right. 100 victims all at once.
Yeah, the data services companies, the big data services companies like your, you know, Accenture and Cognizant, those guys are all targets as well.
Yeah.
For the same reason, they're touching multiple big enterprises. Okay, so we've got containment. That's phase one.
Absolutely.
Phase two, what are we doing next?
Phase two, I'll step into a parallel mode
okay.
where I start kind of the psychology part of my job and the therapist role and start helping to manage and start delegate. So, you know, get in touch with the executives, the stakeholders, start counseling the business and letting them know that, yes, something very bad has happened, but we'll get through it okay. And usually too, I'll delegate to them, have them start bringing in the law enforcement. First call is always the attorney, not law enforcement first necessarily, but, attorney, if you don't have one, contact your insurance company, they'll arrange for panel counsel. That's going to take a while. So you got to get that process started as quick as possible, because sometimes it takes 6 to 8 hours before they even find a counsel that they want to bring in. But your insurance company will usually have a breach coach or somebody that can kind of help a little bit with that. So get that process started early and have the executive stakeholders or business people do that. And then I'll, on the other side too, I'll also get my security engineers going and starting to work on identifying, you know, how bad the spread is, how far it's gone, and start developing a strategy of how to start working.
Okay. Okay. So one thing I heard there in terms of our 30 pounds of prevention is have cyber insurance.
Yes. And don't just have it be a rider on your standard, you know, business policy.
Right. Get a true cyber policy.
Yeah. And make sure when you get one, have a lawyer go through it. If you have an attorney, have your attorney go through it. Ask the hard questions of the insurance provider. There's an awful lot of exclusions in there.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite cases was Mondelez versus Zurich Insurance. Mm-hmm. This happened during the first Ukraine invasion. And there was a wiper ransomware variant that went out. Didn't actually encrypt anything. It just deleted all the data.
Okay.
So Zurich Insurance said, well, Mondelez, you know, too bad you got hit with this. This is an act of war. This was one nation state acting on another. Act of cyber war. We're not covering any of it.
We don't cover. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen, you know, it's interesting because in my line of work, you know, I run a consultancy. I'm a CISO who runs a consultancy. And we partner with an MSSP and we partner with a cyber insurance broker who represents multiple insurers. And I had to go do the research on these brokers. And it turns out, not only to your point, are there all these clauses and exclusions that are in there. There are people that are paying the same amount and getting like a fourth of the coverage.
Right.
Like you'll see $1 million policy and $250,000 policy. And it's like, wait a minute, $250,000 isn't going to do anything in a big scenario. And so coverage rates, the premiums, and then what they actually require as baselines these days, all the insurers are getting smart. It used to just be they'd send you a questionnaire and everybody, of course, would say, yeah, we got everything. We're cool. Right. You know.
Right.
And what's happening now instead is they're getting very prescriptive. And I've even seen one insurer who was actually naming brands like thou shalt have Carbon Black or Cylance or CrowdStrike. Like,
right.
You know, they give you some choices, but they are naming brands of tools you must deploy. And others are a little less prescriptive than that. I'm seeing some interesting stuff. But what I found was I was trying to figure out what's the bare bones that these guys all require. And MFA.
Mm-hmm.
And security awareness training were high on the list. But after that, almost every one of these carriers, their list was slightly different from the other guys.
Yeah, very true.
Everybody's like, here's our five requirements. And it wasn't the same five carrier over carrier. So I was, you know, trying to figure out, like, what do I recommend to my customers? And I ended up just deciding it's a superset. Like, you're going to have to do right. all 11 or 12 of these things. And now you can talk to multiple insurers, compare rates, compare premiums, compare coverage, and do all of that. So, yeah, cyber insurance is interesting now.
Yeah.
And well, I love your advice on get a lawyer.
And I would argue, too, the one of the great things about following the superset methodology is you're truly leaning into that security paradigm that we all want to follow. It's
right.
layers, man. Just have them all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to be fair, you can't secure yourself out of business and spend so much on defenses that you can't operate your business.
Right.
But make smart choices and have all those layers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
not
it.
Not only will help you reduce your premiums and qualify for the insurance, but hopefully it will help you avoid the incident in the first place.
Okay. So. I like that. I like that a lot. All right, so we've covered phase one, phase two. We've done the parallel. We're starting to do the therapy. We're starting to spin up the security engineering teams. We've done containment. What's phase three?
Yeah, usually start trying to – so I'll have some of the security engineering teams try to hunt for patient zero, see if we can find the actual compromised machine, if there's just one, if it's not, you know, spread across the whole network and there's a lot of lateral movement. Depending on the sophistication, you know, it varies. Depends on who came to visit or how many people came to visit. We've dealt with some where we found three or four different threat actors in the environment because they left open RDP to the world. And don't, people, if you're listening, if you have 3389 exposed to the outside world, do not do that. Turn it off. Get a VPN. I don't care how convenient it is or how essential, find a way around it, because you're going to have unwanted visitors, and you're going to be dealing with incident response faster than you want to.
And there have always been good exploits against RDP. Like it comes up, you know, every few years somebody figures out a way to pop it.
Yep.
And get admin and be straight in the box, and that's just it's just a sketchy protocol.
Yeah, there's no reason. I mean, it's tremendously convenient, but there's no reason to have that in your business today. Yeah, you're just asking for trouble.
Exactly. I like that. Okay, so now we found patient zero. Let's say it's a scenario where we were able to actually find, this is the person who clicked, and this is the machine that first got infected. And apparently all it's done is, like, you know, let's say they got shared drives
right.
mapped and mounted. So one machine and a couple of file servers, and that's your contained zone. What are your next steps from there?
Yep. So what I was doing kind of earlier in the containment phase, by having the network engineer build me a segregated zone, we'll call that our clean net. You know, we'll leave the infected things on the dirty net. We found patient zero. We found that it encrypted some file shares. So hopefully that means some of the other workstations are good. So I can take some of my NOC team or some of my, I don't even need the security personnel necessarily, but I'll have them start running it through just a basic process-based remediation standpoint to see if that machine is clean or not, see if it has any signs of infection. While they're working on that, they're able to start getting some of the workers back online. Sure, they're not going to have their file shares. You know, we've got everything segregated, but at least if they're using cloud-based email, they can get to cloud-based email. You know, hopefully they have access to some functionality, which kind of speaks to the importance of business continuity planning. You've got to prioritize and tier that out beforehand so that when all of this panic is happening and all this chaos is going on, you're not just guessing at what to bring up or whose machine to recover first.
And you're operating according to a plan you have tested in tabletop exercises.
Yes, at least once a year. Yeah. You know, I know it's a lot of time. The other thing, as I said during the panel earlier, you have to bring in the business stakeholders. This is not an IT and cyber exercise. We tend to already know relatively well what we're dealing with, but those outside business holders need to be aware of what we're going to see and face.
Yep, I love that. It's just a true fact that every aspect of the business gets involved. When a real incident hits and you're in a real recovery, in a real disaster scenario, you've got marketing wanting to know what we're saying to our customers and to our people. You got legal having a say on what marketing wants to say. You got the CEO wanting updates and wanting to know what the heck is going on. You've got, you know.
Yeah.
And so if you don't involve those folks in your tabletops.
Right. And that's the thing, too, is you don't want to be, if you're the incident commander trying to orchestrate all of this, you don't want 15 people coming to you saying, when is this going to be up? When is that going to be up? What do I tell the guy who's on the phone? You want to have already delegated that. Usually in your first incident response test, when you're tabletopping it out, too, you know, you'll realize, hey, we need a prepared statement. We need to have an internal communications policy to tell our staff what not to do.
Playbooks, runbooks.
And if we're going to send people home, we need to tell them, you know, tell our employees, it's very important when you go home not to post on social media and say, yay, got the day off, company got ransomware. You know, have that, have those conversations. They're weird. You know, and the line staff, depending on your business, may not understand that. They may not really know what you're telling them or why, but have those conversations ahead of time and remind people it's very important not to disclose company happenings outside of the.
I like that. Internal comms is just as important as external comms.
Yep.
That's a great assessment. All right, so we've contained.
Right.
And we are slowly coming back up. We have educated our staff. We are exercising a true BCDR plan that we've tested before with tabletops. We start bringing up machines. What's next?
Yeah. In addition to the individual endpoints, if you can, you know, hopefully maybe you've even got a cloud-based virtual recovery environment where you can spin up a known clean backup, start restoring servers, start bringing up more complex business systems.
Okay.
Again, keeping it fully segregated. Nothing, that dirty net is gone. Nothing from there is talking out.
Right.
I'm sorry if the backups were a week old and you need that data from yesterday, you're just going to have to wait.
Too bad. So sad. Yeah. Well, and this brings us to another thing when we talk about BCDR and planning is RTO and RPO.
Absolutely.
You should know what the heck they are. You should have a plan, and you should test your backups.
And the other thing is get your business stakeholders to sign off on those RTOs and RPOs.
Yes.
And if they say, hey, an 8-hour, you know, recovery time is not acceptable to us, then say, okay, I need the budget. Here's what it's going to cost me to move that RTO down from 8 to 4 hours. And then if they don't want to spend that money, have them sign off and say, okay, just kidding. 8 hours is good enough.
Eight it is, yeah.
Same thing with recovery points. You know, if they say, okay, I can lose 1 week of business data, simulate that with them during a DR plan. And make them realize what that's going to feel like. And then again, if they don't like that and they want it faster, then show them some budget, plan it out, and say this is how to get lower.
All the work all these line workers have done over the last week is gone.
Yep.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah.
It's good to stress test and exercise that as well, for sure.
Yeah. A lot of that too comes to the risk appetite and risk tolerance of the business stakeholders too, because some of them will say, oh, I'm, you know, super risk tolerant. You know, I'm willing to gamble and roll the dice a lot. And then when you say, hey, how about those 2 weeks of, 40 employees putting data into the system? Is that really something that you're willing to gamble on? And they're like, geez, that's a lot of dollars I just spent on staffing that I've got to respend.
One ransomware incident that I helped manage, I was an incident commander on this one, but I was involved in it. And it was a small county hospital in the middle of nowhere in some, small county in the U.S. And they ended up having to revert to their old paper processes.
Yeah.
And so every patient coming in, there were physical charts being written on and passed around and, every exit and every, and doing it all on paper. And they ended up having to spend about, I want to say it almost took them 5 weeks to get fully recovered.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they had this massive backlog of 5 weeks of paper that they had to re-enter into the system and get back into digital form. And that's, that's a business that had a method that was non-digital.
Yep.
Had something they could fall back on, obviously a huge data entry burden at the end of that, but they were able to function and keep going strictly on paper, and they had it planned that way. Payroll is another good example.
Mm-hmm.
Payroll systems go down. I always tell people, keep those physical checks around because you never know, right? Like you may have to be signing checks and mailing them, but you can get payroll made. I wonder about all the rest of the world where we don't necessarily have those paper backups.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's definitely one of the first things too during that incident response plan test, which I can't focus how heavily important that is to prepare. We'll talk through things, and one of the things you want to inject into the scenario is, okay, call your customer list. Well, I'll log into SAP. Sorry, SAP's down. That's part of what got encrypted, So make sure you've got those paper printouts of critical contacts, critical employee phone contacts.
Playbooks, runbooks. One thing I've seen too in the bigger shops that get popped. Generally speaking, if it's a much larger enterprise, the bad guys were around for quite some time before they actually pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
And one of the hallmarks that we're seeing now that I've seen in the big shops is the bad guys will keep scouring and scanning and looking at all the file shares and all the mounts and all the SharePoints and all the whatevers until they find the cyber insurance policy.
Yeah, they want to know how much money they can ask for in the ransom.
Exactly.
There's formulas and tables. It's tremendously sophisticated. And the relationship between cyber insurance and the criminal enterprises is kind of complex. They tend to develop a little bit of a, I don't want to call it quite a rapport. They're not friends, but they can negotiate much more cleanly because they deal with each other fairly often and they know how the game is played. They ask for, $100 million. They know that the insurance policy is good for $5 million so that they can probably get $5 million out of the end. And they'll walk through it and kind of talk back and forth with the negotiator from the insurance company and the ransomware operator.
And this is the modern age where we do negotiate with the ransomware.
Yeah, absolutely. The old axiom of don't negotiate with terrorists seems to have gone out the window.
It seems to have. It seems like almost every business actually engages and talks to them now.
Yeah.
But then there's also the fact that they're not the best software authors. I know one company that negotiated, paid, was handed the decryption tool, and the decryption tool didn't work.
Yeah, or in the case of one of the incidents I worked, they'd been encrypted 3 separate times by 3 different visitors because they had RDP open to the WAN. So they'd been encrypted 3 separate times before they realized they were in trouble.
Oh, my goodness.
So, sure, they paid for the first one. They decrypted, and it worked somewhat, but it just gave them back more encrypted data. And at that point, the ransomware note from the second agency had been overwritten or deleted as part of the third one that went in encrypted. So there was no way of getting that data back.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's definitely a don't leave RDP open on the internet story there, if ever there was one. My goodness.
I would say, too, one kind of old school, you mentioned the paper processes is a good business failover. Another old practice that people kind of got away from, rotate a USB backup offline at least once a week or once a month at the bare minimum, but have some degree of backup that's truly kept offline. Don't rely on a cloud repository is offline. Yeah, truly air gapped.
Yeah.
That's your parachute. If all else fails, you've at least got something to go from.
Right. At the end of the day, in a ransomware cleanup event, right? At the end of the day, ultimately, it's just about getting the data back.
Right.
I mean, because you can pay the ransom, you can do the decryption, you can do all the things. But if you've got really clean, really recent backups and you're willing to only lose that couple of hours of work, you just restore.
Right.
Find out how they got in.
Yeah. Yeah. And stop
that. Stop that so they don't come right back again. And I have seen, to your point, I have actually witnessed online backups get ransomed as well. Like we hit the main, we hit the backups, and we're out.
Yep. And you think, you know, oh, I've got MFA on it. Well, if they're sitting there on your servers and you're logging into that backup environment to check the backup state or whatever you're using, they can grab that session token. They can grab those cookies. They can pass them through. And they'll sit there and do that surveillance and reconnaissance to maximize the impact and damage.
And it all starts like in the Windows environments, right? Golden tickets and Kerber hosting and all that goodness.
Yep.
You know, it used to be you only had to worry about protecting admin, and now any given user is a full-on vector into the nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, you can just leverage it. And because the most modern iterations of ransomware are double or triple extortion, where it's not just about encrypting, and in fact, a couple of the groups now are skipping the encryption.
Yeah, they're threatening to release.
Yeah, they're just looking to steal your data, and they're doing it low and slow. You know, one of the incidents I worked, we saw a massive 12 gig exfil in the network logs when we went through it. And it was real easy. It was like, okay, that's where they stole your data. The more recent ones, you just see a trickle. And it's going out to public cloud services just like your users would be if they're syncing their iPhone photos or whatever. And you know, when they're contacting you for the ransom, they're saying, hey, here are screenshots of your customer data that we have in our environment. We're going to put this out on our website.
Yeah.
And we need $10 million to not make it happen.
And there it is. Just revealing the data alone is sufficient in most cases. Just to have it known that your data got out, because it's not your data, it's your customer data.
Right, right.
Just to have it known that it got out is a huge black eye.
Yeah.
And then when it actually gets out, that's, you know, that it's bad that it's out. It's bad that it's known that it's out. It's a twofer. You're suffering for two reasons, really. Because there's reputation loss, there's angry customers, there's lawsuits, there's all of that.
Well, and now there's the SEC. What was it? It wasn't Caesars. I can't remember which of the recent ones, but they actually filed the SEC report because the company had failed to make the SEC incident disclosure.
Yeah.
So the ransomware gang did it for them.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I can't remember
that was just in January, too. And I don't remember.
Talk about hubris.
Right.
That is some cocky bad guys right there. Oh, we filed your SEC report for you since you failed to.
Yep.
And we know all the details intimately. Right.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Well, James, have you got any other tips, any other advice, anything else? Related to incident response, I feel like we've covered all the sort of the baseline you need to do beforehand. We walked through an incident, walked through the phases and stages. What other tips or tricks have you got around incident response?
I would say if you're a technology company or if you're a large enterprise, make friends with your local FBI field office.
Yes.
Talk to the cyber squad there and just say, hey, I just wanted to introduce myself. You know, we're a large enterprise that, you know, has 10,000 employees in your area. And we just wanted to have a phone number to contact just in case we do end up victimized.
I love it.
They will call you sometimes too. Do vet them if you get a call from the FBI.
Yes.
Also, you know, knowing that field office phone number is really good because if somebody pretends to be from the FBI.
I have actually seen that.
Yes.
I have seen the fake FBI calls.
Right.
Right in the middle of the ransom event when you're all panicked and scrambling and don't have time to do the verification and you just start sharing details. And
when you're in panic mode, you know, your logic is down, your emotion is up.
Yeah.
And that's, again, too, where the tabletops help. If you drill and you prepare, you can keep your logic
high. Keep the emotional stuff in check and get the logic.
But yeah, the FBI will actually help quite a bit. Not so much with the recovery or the investigation side of it, but if you provide them some of the data or if you give them access to, they'll take if you want, you know, if you're willing to do so, they'll take, if you want to send them a virtual machine, you know, the infected system, they'll go through it forensically and they'll try to figure out as much about the threat actor as
they can. And they'll capture those IOCs and share them out in theory with the other enterprises that are part of their network.
Yeah.
That's always useful. Although I will tell you this, I have plenty of times seen where the corporate lawyer said, nope.
Yep, absolutely. No,
do not
certainly
contact
fall
them.
To your counsel. But I will say, having worked with the cyber squads in a couple of different branches, they truly treat the company as a victim, and they're your identity. You know, they're not putting it in public documents. They're not saying, you know, James Keeler Inc. was compromised. They're just saying, hey, we found threat actor X doing bad things.
And that's good. As long as they maintain that anonymity, then the lawyer should be okay with it and should throttle back. And you're right, it adds value. It's helpful. It's good for the community and for Guard and some of these other organizations. You know, it's like you want to share that data. It's the same thing as having an ISAC, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing too is if you can, don't pay the ransom. You're just empowering these guys. Not only are you funding nation state terrorism, you're literally buying tanks for Iran or nuclear weapons for North Korea. You're also letting the bad guys hire, you know, a PhD instead of a master's computer scientist to develop the ransomware. The ransomware industry had almost died back around, I think, 2015 or so. And then cyber insurance came along and they were like, hey, we can cash in and get the cyber insurance became the venture capital to fund the ransomware.
Oh my goodness,
that's
a horrible way to put it, but how accurate a statement.
Yeah.
I love it. The cyber insurance is the VC of ransomware gangs.
It really, really was.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Well, James, thank you so much for chatting with me. This was really fun. What about the conference itself? What have you enjoyed so far?
Oh, it's great. One of the things that we need to realize is shifting to a default deny posture and only allowing things by exception that we need to for a business reason is the only way we're ever going to get ahead of this problem.
True zero trust.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's difficult, and it's a major paradigm shift for the end users, especially when they're used to having a flexible. Especially now too, as they all have iPhones and Androids, where you know they think they're master computers because they can install an app and go to a cloud service and do things.
Yeah.
Telling them that, no, you can only do things on corporate devices that your corporate central IT has authorized. It's a big lift.
It is a big lift.
But it's well worth it, and it's the only way we'll stop the attackers, especially who are using the IT tools against us.
Yep, full agreement. And I'm a big believer that zero trust applies to every aspect and entity, right? In other words, you know, ThreatLocker's got this great zero trust paradigm on the apps, but I want to see the same thing on the identities. I want to see the same thing on the entities. I want to see the same thing on the network. I want to see the same thing on software that might talk to software.
Yep,
and, you know,
their
like
APIs.
All of that. Don't trust anything should be the mantra ever,
right.
you know?
I heard a great analogy comparing it to the Pentagon. You know, it's like it's difficult to get into the Pentagon. Once you're in the outer ring, you've authenticated, you've passed your way in, but then you want to go to the next ring. You know, you've got to go through the authentication step again. They've already let you into the building. They know that you're worth, you know, you're trustworthy enough to get into that outer ring.
Yeah.
But every ring you're going deeper into, they're checking you again. And the steps are getting harder to get deeper and deeper.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. That's exactly it. You know,
that's what we got to do for everything.
Yeah. Mistrust or distrust, I guess, is the right word. Any identity, even the ones you think you know.
Right.
That's it. All right. Well, James, thank you so much for chatting with me. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.